Listen to John 15. Greater love has no one than this, that one lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends, the Lord said. Any wonder that we don't derive our real sense of relational love and purpose from our relationship with Christ? We think of him as kind of up there. Real love comes from this person sitting here who walks up and says, Larry, you're a blessing, I love you. And I say, that's where I really get my needs met. Thank you, Lord, for dying. Appreciate that. But, oh, this is the person I need. Do you see? Where are we turning to get our needs met? Is it in the Lord? My basic principle behind all my counseling is this, that my relationship with Christ is sufficient to meet my basic core needs for security. Did you ever read Song of Solomon? And if you take that allegorically, which is one possible interpretation, where you have the bridegroom representing the Christ, you have the bride representing the church, you and me, those who know Christ as Savior. Have you ever noticed there that the Lord, in picture form, and in the bridegroom, the Lord describes his bride, his lover, in very elegant terms, and calls her beautiful and wonderful, and he loves her very much. And then you read very shortly after he gives this glowing description of her, you read that his bride fails the bridegroom. Remember the story in Song of Solomon chapter 5? Remember the story where the bridegroom is coming to meet with his bride on their wedding night? And he knocks at the door, I'm here. And the bride says, oh, it's a long walk to the door to get out of my bed, and I'm all perfumed and dressed so pretty, I might get my feet dirty. I'm not sure if I really want to come let you in. I might start sweating in the activity, and I'm not interested in that. I'm too beautiful to be get my feet dirty and to perspire. She became more preoccupied with her own loveliness than with her relationship with her lover. And then finally she went. And when he went to the door, the bridegroom was gone. Has the Lord ever withdrawn from you? When he does, what's his attitude? Is it because he's mad? Of course he'll never leave nor forsake, but has his presence in some sense, have you been robbed of the reality of his presence on occasion? As many of my counselees and myself have been on occasion. When the Lord comes back, what's his attitude toward you when you've fallen into sin, when your counselee has done that which displeased the Lord? What's his attitude? What's your attitude towards somebody who lets you down? You see them the next time after they let you down, the next time you see them, what do you feel like saying? Hey, you know what? You really burned me up. What did the Lord say after he saw his bride again after the fall, if you will? His first words are, you're gorgeous. You're beautiful. Somebody who's never going to turn me away. Now, folks, that's security. That's security. That's significance. That's value. I'm important to God. But the problem with so many people that we counsel is this, and so many of us, that we've been infiltrated in our thinking by a very wrong view that God is just not relevant to life in a very special way at all. He's good for religion, he's good for Sunday, but he's not good for a guy who used to stutter, he's not good for a guy who had pimples, he's not good for a guy whose dad didn't see him hit a home run, he's not really somehow adequate or sufficient or relevant to those deep, deep, deep personal needs. Where do we get that idea? Shouldn't it be obvious that God is centrally relevant to that? Where do we get these wrong ideas? Do you watch television? What do our kids learn as they watch television? We were sharing at dinner with Wes and his wife about the fact that some years ago we became very concerned about our children. We have two boys, 8 and 11 now. And a couple of years ago, it became very clear to me that our children were identifying with very secular heroes. The Fonz, you know, and an arrogant flippancy and a macho. You could be a man, you'd wear a black leather coat and do this kind of a thing and all that. And I thought, what are the values my children are learning? As they watch The Incredible Hulk. Did you ever see the Hulk pray about his problem? Did you ever see Wonder Woman thank the Lord for his gift to her of beauty and ask the Lord how he would want her to use her beauty for his glory? Well, of course not. That almost sounds absurd. What's the lesson getting through to my two boys? You don't need God. He's not relevant. You can have an exciting life like Wonder Woman and the Hulk and Fonz. You can do all that stuff and have a great life. And God, he's great for Sunday. Yeah, if your dad sticks it on you, endure devotions, but then go out and have a real life. You see? I was concerned about that, so some time ago I I got together with my dad, and we're writing a children's novel in which we have a Christian hero. A hero for our kids to identify with. It became bedtime stories, and now it's in the form of a novel. A man whose name is Al Scabbard, Captain Al Scabbard, who has some other friends, and they're all Christians, but we're not pushing Christianity, we're assuming it in their life. When Scabbard gets in trouble, he prays. When he doesn't know what's happening, he says, "Lord, what's going on?" When he has a bad temper and yells at his wife, he says, "Honey, I'm sorry, forgive me." We don't teach Christianity in this book, we assume it. And the hope is that perhaps my children will come to see through this medium that God is centrally relevant to their lives. That might be one more way of helping, because I have basic needs. My kids have basic needs. You have basic needs. My counselors have basic needs. And only God can meet those basic needs, but we go in every direction other than Him to get our needs met, and that's why we're fouled up, basically. I believe. That's the fact that we're personal beings. I think your outline talks about that, doesn't it? The concept of personal needs, security, and significance. Is next on your outline the concept that man is a rational being? What time did I start, Norm? What time do I stop? Okay, another 10 minutes or so, perhaps. People think. That's part of what it means to be made in the image of God. In the image of God, I'm a personal being who needs love, needs significance. In the image of God, I'm a rational being who can think. And do you realize, well, I believe to be the case, that how I think is centrally influential in how I feel and what I do. How I think is terribly, terribly important. Do you understand that it's not truth that controls anybody? It's our perception of truth. What I believe to be true is what controls me. If you believe there's a lion in the hallway, that would control your behavior. You wouldn't go out the door. Now, there's no lion, but if you believed it, your behavior, your emotions would be controlled not by truth that there's no lion, but by your perception that there is a lion. It's perception of truth that controls behavior. Let me illustrate. Some years ago, to illustrate the importance of thinking and the control of behavior and feeling. Some years ago, my wife, who's been very actively involved with Christian Women's Club, headquartered in Stonecroft, Kansas City, went there for a convention. She was gone for a week. And I was home alone with our two boys, no lady of the house present. She was gone for a week. And Thursday of that week, she'd been gone about 4 or 5 days. Thursday of that week, I was at work. That morning, Thursday morning, about 10:30 or 11 o'clock, the phone rang in my office, and my secretary answered it. And I was standing there, and she told me, "It's your dentist's receptionist, and she was calling your wife to make an appointment for some dental work that Rachel was having done. And when she called your home, dialed your number, the phone rang, and somebody answered it. And the receptionist, our dentist receptionist, said to the person who answered, a male voice, 'Now, is Mrs. Crabb home, please?' And the male voice said, 'No, Mrs. Crabb is not home. This is the phone man.' And our dentist receptionist thought that was strange enough to warrant a phone call to my office. I hadn't called the phone company. The phone wasn't out of order as far as I knew, so I dialed my number. It was busy. My kids were at school, my wife's in Kansas City, and someone's talking on my phone. Nobody's home. So I called the phone company, and I said, 'Will you check this number?' They checked it and said, 'Someone's on your phone.' And I said, 'Nobody's home.' My secretary thoughtfully said, 'How does it feel to know your house is being robbed?' And I thought, well, wait a minute, crooks don't answer phones when they're robbing houses. But I thought it merited a phone call to the police, because I didn't know what was happening, so I called the police. And you know, what do you say? You say, "Police, somebody's on my phone, and nobody's home, and I wonder if you could, you know, could you meet me there, and would you mind getting there first?" And, so I waited a few minutes, and I drove home, and I got home, and there were two police cars parked outside of my home by the time I got there. The front door was locked. The policemen were inside the house. They had come in through the back door that was unlocked, the back screen door on our patio. I unlocked the front door, went in. The policeman said, "You're Mr. Crabb?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Somebody's been through your house looking for something. The house is a wreck. Things are turned all over the place. They were looking for art objects or jewelry or what do you have?" I said, "You know, art objects. I painted a sketch once and, you know, put it behind the drawer. We have nothing of any particular value." And he said, "Well, the house has been..." the house has been gone over with a fine-tooth comb. You better check through and tell me what's missing. So I went through the house, and I came back after a thorough search, and I said, "Sir, the house is the way I left it this morning." Is this. What control? My wife had been away for 4 days at this point. She needs to have you know that. We live somewhat differently. What controlled that policeman? He was lamenting about the crime wave and filling out a crime report and disgusted with all the criminals. What was controlling him? Truth? His perception of truth. He didn't know the truth. But he believed that nobody lived that way. It must have been a criminal. And it was that belief. That's a true story. It was that belief which controlled him. Do you see? It's what I think that controls what I do. It's what I think that controls what I feel. How do I think? The question I hear is asked. Who was on the phone? We don't know is the answer to the question. We've assumed that a phone man might have been in the pole outside of our home and was fixing it from there or making some adjustments. That's all we can figure because the house was in fine shape. There was nobody. Do you see? It's how we think. Now, you know what? We learn all sorts of crazy ideas that we think. We believe certain things that simply do not square with truth. Some time ago, a personal illustration, listen to me. Some time ago, our son, when he was in third grade school teacher called us up and said, "I have a problem with your boy." I said, "What's the problem?" She said, "Well, it's very minor, but I just want to mention it to you. After school today, on the way out, your son stopped by my desk to say, 'I hate you,' and walked out the door." What do you do? I'm supposed to know how to handle these things. I had no idea what to do. So I thought about it. I said, "Well, Lord, you got to give me wisdom here. I don't know what's happening inside my kid's head, but I knew something in his thinking had gone wrong. I didn't know what it was." So I prayed for wisdom. God gives wisdom. About 2 weeks later, we were having an evening with some friends of ours, a couple that we know who have some kids, had invited some friends of theirs from out of town to spend the evening with them, and the Crabs were invited to come spend the evening with these two couples. And this third couple, the visiting couple, were very musical. The fellow played the guitar and sang, and we spent the evening in their living room. This other couple essentially giving us a concert for the evening. Lovely music. When we knew a chorus, we'd join in, but they pretty much sang for the entire evening. A very pleasant evening of relaxed fellowship. We got in the car to go home. I was feeling good. Rachel was feeling good. Kids were feeling good. My son said to me, "Dad, I sure felt sorry for you tonight." I said, "What?" You know what he said? "Now listen. You know why I felt sorry for you, Dad?" I said, "Why?" "You weren't the star." Oh, wow. What did my foolish child learn from his foolish daddy? In our church, I lead the singing. I do some of the preaching. When we travel someplace, it's usually so I can speak. Have I communicated to him that what's important to me is being up front? I was concerned. Went back to his school teacher and talked for a little while. We found out that my son was the first one with his hand in the air for every question. And the day that he said, "I hate you," was the day the teacher had said, I want you to put your hand down and give some other kids a chance. My child believed, he believed that the way to be a somebody was to be the guy up front. The teacher denied him the opportunity to be that. Workshop this afternoon, what's the phrase? Blocked goals. And my son was mad. It's how we think that determines how we feel. It's how we think that determines what we do. Are you aware that every event that happens in my life, every event that happens in your life, that my first response to it is what? It's an evaluative response. I think about that event. And it's how I think about that event that determines how I respond to that event. How do I evaluate that event? Folks, that's behind most of your marital squabbles. Behind most of our marital squabbles. We always have marital squabbles when I'm giving a workshop on marriage. Some time ago, I was getting ready to go to a workshop, and I made the classic husband's error. I chose my slacks before I checked my socks. And I picked a pair of green and yellow plaid pants that I think are a knockout. I had a yellow coat to go with it, white shirt, green tie, gorgeous outfit, and I have a pair of green socks that go with that outfit. I had my pants on, had my shirt on, was getting my tie out, and thought, hey, better get my socks on. So I opened the drawer. You know what I found in the drawer? One green sock. How did I think about that event? Picture your mind like a tape recorder. If you could have tape recorded my brain, what would you have heard me say? You'd have probably heard me say, doggone it. Doesn't Rachel think my ministry is important enough to wash some socks so I can go preach? Something as dumb as that, you likely would have heard. And so I called out to my wife. I said, honey, you always should start with honey when you're in the middle of a conference. I said, honey, I said, there's only one green sock in my drawer. And of course I meant, where's the other one? But I didn't have the courage to ask that. And so I said, there's only one green sock in my drawer. Do you know what she said? That's what she said. How is she evaluating this event of my saying, oh, do you see? She was perceiving it as a threat to her security. Do you see that? And I was perceiving a trivial event like one green sock as a threat to my significance. And so I said to my wife, I said, well, where's the other green sock? And she said, which was no help. Now, I went and checked next to the hamper, and there on the floor was one dirty green sock. And I yelled back to my wife, and I said, honey, for crying out loud, if you love me, you can look next to the hamper. Do you see what's going on in our situation? Do you see that how we're thinking about these events is determining our absurdly immature response to a green sock? We solved the problem, folks. I bought six pairs of green socks. Sometimes psychology must yield to practicality. Are you getting my points? Let's back up and review the points, and then let's stop. If we're going to be biblical counselors, we must first of all be sure that we're speaking from truth. God has said. That truth, if we understand it rightly, will minister to the real human condition. People who stutter and who have pimples and whose dad missed their home runs and who've been raped and whose children are sick and whose marriages are falling apart and whose wives have left them. Biblical counseling, which springs from truth, will minister to those very real needs which I have and which you have. Now that's true.